You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Dana Priest is an investigative reporter with The Washington Post, who's won two Pulitzer Prizes, one for beat reporting in 2006 and the other for public service in 2008. Her ongoing series in the paper, Top Secret America, explores the security buildup that followed the September 11th terrorist attacks. And tonight, the PBS series Frontline is airing her report called Are We Safer?, which follows Ms. Priest and her colleagues as they investigate the growing reach of government intelligence. It airs at 9 tonight, and I'm very pleased that it brings Dana Priest back to our show. Hi, Dana.
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay. How long have you been working on this series for The Washington Post?
Oh, it's been over 2 years now. It's really been quite an endeavor. You know, I never, ever thought something would take that long, and at the end of 1 year, we sort of looked at each other, my colleagues and I, and said, we're not nearly done. And the reason it took so long was we just had no idea that the world that's been created to respond to 9/11 was as big as it is and as difficult it is to unearth.
And at the end of the show tonight, which has been paired with another show on airline safety, you suggest that there's a lot more to be done. Have you been... Go ahead.
There certainly is. It's every time you open one door, there are three others in front of you that suggest they need to be opened too. So we're not nearly to the bottom of it all yet.
Have you been working in conjunction with Frontline the whole time? Is there any difference from what you've been reporting for the Post and what we'll be seeing tonight?
Yes, there is. I mean, I've worked very closely with them almost from the beginning, not quite, because you always want to see if you're going to be able to do something before you bring even more resources into it. But when they came together, I actually said, are you sure you want to do this? Because there aren't, television's visual, and this is one of the most difficult visual reporting efforts I've made, because everything that we're talking about is classified top secret. So, you know, the government purposely doesn't want you to be able to take pictures of whatever it is. So, you know, they said, no, this is an important story. We'd like to give it a try. And they have, as you probably know, this new magazine format that is appearing tonight for the first time. It's going to be once a month. So they did stick with it in trying to, you know, pull out our hair, trying to figure out how do we put all these findings to film. And luckily, we came up with a lot of ways. And what's different tonight is, first of all, it's a real emphasis on one part of the series, the last part, which is on the domestic intelligence gathering. And the case study that we pick is not a case study that's in the newspaper. It's the Maryland State Police, who, after a couple years ago, having given the green light to go and look more carefully within the state of Maryland for potential terrorists, ended up spying on 50 Americans who had nothing to do with terrorism, who were basically peaceful protesters of the war and of climate change and other things like that. And it sort of tells you how this all happened, what the state of Maryland thought about it, and then what they're doing today in terms of intelligence gathering against people who, again, the majority of which have no connection to terrorism at all.
Was that just because they built up a massive database and felt they had to use the material they'd collected, or is this also a matter of, well, once you start looking for enemies, your political inclinations might take over and you might go after environmentalists and mm-hmm. peace activists and the like?
I think it's a little bit of both. I don't really think politics, as you and I would define it, is in there necessarily. I think it's a question of training and how you equate a protest with potential terrorism, which was a big question on my mind. You know, let's just say they wanted to do the right thing, but still, how would you do that? And the answer really is, well, they can always be a cover for terrorism. Demonstrations can. People might slip in that you don't even know about. That really is a question of what is a terrorist and how do we know that they work? And that's one of the big problems with bringing in thousands of local and state law enforcement agencies who want to be part of this effort but aren't necessarily trained in how terrorism comes about and the people involved. And so they apply their, you know, best judgments to that, and the best judgments in some cases turn out to be completely ridiculous, as they did in this case.
Well, as you
but
point out.
But your other point about the database is really good, too. You know, once you create a database that can do so many different things, then the sort of natural imperative is, well, let's fill it up with other data and see what we can do with that. And so now they have databases, the FBI does, but also a lot of local police that are based in some part on commercially available data crunching software that you and I could buy if we had enough money. And then I can figure out, you know, where you've lived all your life, what your social security number is. I can probably find your cell phone numbers and all this sort of thing. Police don't even have to ask themselves right now, should we be getting this? They can buy it from a commercial vendor. And then they start to say, okay, now we have it. Let's see what we can do with it. Can we start analyzing patterns? Can we start looking at people who might be on the very edge of our screen in terms of potential suspicious activities?
Well, the word intelligence suggests intelligence. Weren't some of the potential terrorists on the list Catholic nuns?
Right. That's, again, that is where the bad judgment came in. The Catholic nuns were part of a protest organization that they were looking at. And I don't think in their heart of hearts, you know, they were looking at them because the police agreed with the war and these nuns didn't. I think they were looking at them because they were protesters. And by the nature of protest, you're questioning the government. And that's where the poor judgment came in. You cannot equate questioning government and what it does with violent jihad terrorism.
Well,
so, you know, they have turned around and done a lot of training. Hopefully that won't happen again. But, you know, we saw another case of it just recently in Pennsylvania where, again, the police wanting to really participate in this effort to find so-called homegrown terrorists, had a contractor who laid out, the possible threats to the state, and again, it included terrorism. It included anti-war protesters, climate change people even who wanted to stop the coal gasification industry or to dampen it down, animal rights activists, anyone who would go out on the street, basically. And their official word for why they did that is, you know, anything like that could be a cover for terrorism, any kind of big protest. And of course, there's no indication that's ever been a cover for terrorism. So it's a question of, you know, why were they allowed to do that? And I come back to the notion that if you're going to ask all of these hundreds, thousands of local police to do this, you have to make sure that they have training, not just in what not to do, but in the subject of terrorism. And that caused another problem. A lot of trainers, or some trainers at least, that have been hired by some of these local governments turn out to be people who are on what I would generously call the fringe of some understanding of Islam, where, you know, they are spouting a very Islamophobic type of view that most Muslims are radical and that most mosques are radical. And this is gaining some traction around the country, including among law enforcement people who are sent to these training sessions and really don't know any better. And that's also a huge problem, because you can see that almost causing a problem that doesn't exist right now, which is the further alienation of Muslims in the United States.
My guest is Dana Priest of the Washington Post, also the reporter for part of a Frontline show tonight, this one called Are We Safer? It broadcasts at 9 o'clock here in New York. All of these things cost a lot of money. And you suggest that after 9/11, the threat of terrorism engendered a blank check approach to funding. Anthony Quartisman says on camera, you had something you should never offer a bureaucracy, which is a candy store without a price tag. Where's all the money coming from?
You and me. It's all taxpayer money from, Congress, 9 days after 9/11, Congress gave the Bush administration, the executive branch, basically a blank check. It was the first of supplemental budgeting that was in the tens of billions of dollars that continued. Remember, back then, everybody was worried that there was going to be another attack, and their instinct was to do what they could at the time, and what Congress could do, because it holds the purse strings, is to give over some more money, and they did, and they gave so much that they couldn't absorb it in a rational way, and started building many, many new organizations and plussing up other organizations, some of which definitely needed to be changed and increased and made a lot better.
Well, at the time, there was a lot of concern because intelligence was not working in this country, and we had to reorganize. And wasn't this just
exactly
part of that approach?
It was. It was a part of the approach was to reorganize, but also to get bigger. The FBI, for instance, which really does have the lead for terrorism in the United States, was half the size that it, or the agents that were devoted to terrorism were half the size that it is now. They didn't, not only didn't they have really the resources to do the work that they are central to doing in the United States, but they didn't have computer systems that could talk to each other. They didn't have other sorts of equipment that they needed to try to do their own data analysis. And so they've been given, lots of money to do that. They set up a whole new branch of the FBI. But so did every other organization, and especially the military, because, of course, they would be fighting wars overseas. But the military here that does counterintelligence and other sorts of things in the United States also got a huge plus up, as did every other intelligence organization, of which there are 18, most of them military. The amount of money would, you have to be able to ask yourself, is it more effective? Are we safer? And that's where the program tonight, I won't give it away, but, has some answers and some questions. The bottom line of our reporting shows that it has become so large and unmanageable that it's difficult to see what programs are having an effect and, more importantly, which programs are not just a waste of money but a waste of the time and talent of people who should be pointed to a better way of addressing the question of are we safer.
Well, the film refers to the terrorism industrial complex, and when we come back from a little break, we'll talk about that, and we'll talk about some of the things that this money has created, not just Homeland Security, but also the so-called fusion centers, and talk a bit about the fusion center in Maryland, which is what you focus upon largely in this film. My guest is Dana Priest of The Washington Post. She is also the reporter for a frontline investigation called Are We Safer, which is being broadcast tonight at 9 on Channel 13 here in New York. Stay with us for more. We're back with Dana Priest of The Washington Post talking about a frontline show tonight, Are We Safer? It is being broadcast at 9 p.m. on PBS stations, including Channel 13 here in New York. One of the reasons given for what went wrong in 9/11 was that various intelligence agencies were refusing to share intelligence. Have the changes led to more sharing of intelligence? Has Homeland Security, which was created to take care of that, actually been working in this area?
Well, I do think those are sort of separate answers. One is yes, I think there is more sharing of intelligence between the federal agencies, the CIA and FBI in particular, but also the eavesdropping agency, the National Security Agency, has really gotten into the center of of a lot of what's going on everywhere. But whether or not the Department of Homeland Security has much to do with that. I don't really believe they do. I think the department's role in much of this is still very debated within the intelligence world. What they bring to that world is still a question mark. They don't really have a role that's completely separate from what is being done already or what was being done by FEMA and other existing agencies. They're trying to get better. Their analysis is still second rate, according to people who see it all the time. So that's a big, you know, it's a kind of a symbol of what happened after 9/11 in an effort to share, in an effort to, you know, let the American people know that the government was doing something. They created this gigantic new department. That's the same with the Director of National Intelligence. A position that didn't exist before 9/11 was precisely set up so that it could sit on top of all these agencies and manage them. But the fact is, Congress didn't give them the budget authority or the authority to hire and fire so they could manage. So it's been largely a question of personal persuasion, and that has only worked sometimes. So there is still a lot of questions about the second big bureaucracy that was created, which is the DNI's office, and whether or not that is really adding to what agencies would have and are already doing on their own. And, you know, nobody in Congress has really taken a hard look at that. That's the other problem with intelligence. Because it's so classified, the public cannot really know much about it. And the oversight committees play then a much more important role. And the Intelligence Oversight Committee, both the House and the Senate, are pretty weak. They don't have that much staff to be able to dig into these matters, and they often get resistance when they try. And then they can't tell us much about what they find to add to any sort of public pressure to change. So it's a very it's a unique situation within government because it is so classified. Those committees really need to play a big role, and my reporting indicates that they don't.
What was the philosophy behind the creation of the so-called fusion centers, and how many are there? Mm-hmm. Who oversees them?
The fusion centers, there's 72 of them now.
72?
The fusion centers, 72. So some states have more than one. California has four or perhaps five. I forget right now. But the fusion centers were actually first a reaction by the states after 9/11 because the federal government wouldn't share information about terrorism within a state. And here you have the state authorities who are going to be ultimately held accountable by their voters to safety issues, saying, well, we want more. So they set up a way for the state and local police agencies to share information, bring things together, and they're mainly analytical in nature. The DHS said, well, we really like this idea. You, in fact, could become our frontline eyes and ears, and so we're going to give you money to stand up the physical centers and to create computer networks that will link up to the federal government. And so that's what they've done. And now these fusion centers even are beginning what the government calls suspicious activity reporting, which is a DHS effort along with the Justice Department to get police and other local authorities to put into a master database all, again, suspicious activities that they see, anything from someone photographing a bridge or a federal building to someone who's too interested in the security of a building or, you know, the ins and outs, how you get in and out of it, other things like this. And that's helped to create this larger database with 160,000 case files of potentially suspicious activities that may or may not have a link to terrorism. The other thing that's happened with the fusion centers is because there isn't a lot of work on terrorism in most states, they've transitioned into all crime centers where they are taking, for instance, gang-related data from within the state, all the different agencies within the state, but also a region. And there, I think, you know, you really do have a positive potential, and I think the police would say they have already seen the fruits of that, where you have sharing among agencies that didn't go on quite at the level that it did before on normal crime, as I would call it, on gangs, on drugs, and things like that. And, you know, that's a good thing, but it's being funded under the name of terrorism.
You investigate a fusion center in Maryland. Why that one? Because it was closer to Washington?
No, because it relates to our issue of the Maryland State Police and the activity that they had undertaken vis-a-vis the protest groups, because that had some beginnings with the fusion center. Fusion centers are collections of representatives from various state agencies as well as the state police who run the one in Maryland. So we focused on that because of its origins and connection to that particular case, but then also because Maryland is doing some cutting-edge technology that is, on the one hand, interesting towards in the crime area, but raises some questions about civil liberties. In particular, they have automatic license plate readers now, so a police car can drive through a parking lot and the camera on top of the car will read the license plates going by all the parked cars, and then it can instantly run database checks, not only crime databases, but in Maryland if it has commercial databases or other things, and can tell you whether there's a convicted felon that owns a car, whether this person has a suspended license, and can tell you a whole lot of things instantly, which can lead to, you know, more questions about whether the person is someone that they should stop right away. And that's what they're using it for, not only in Maryland, but for other people.
Is this to some degree in response to the fact that one of the 9/11 bombers was stopped on a traffic violation in Maryland on September 9th, two nights before the attacks?
It is. It's a, you know, of course, Maryland felt terrible about that, but there wasn't anything in their database when they stopped Girard. And so they... Now these databases are all linked together, and the idea is if you stop someone on a routine traffic check, you could then maybe have them on a list that would have asked that you pull them over or call your FBI representative. And that's a good – that would be a good thing. The problem for civil libertarians and others is – that you would be potentially stopping people that actually have a parking ticket to pay and entering them into a different database, which is a database of license plates. Now, that doesn't sound like much of anything, but what it amounts to is that Maryland and other states that have this can now track where cars have driven. So if you become, for some reason, a person of interest, perhaps because you took a picture of the bridge that connects, you know, Maryland to Baltimore, or the tunnel, and you go into this database, then they can backtrack and see where you've been to a certain degree. If you've been through any of the toll roads in Maryland, they can do this without the same standard that would be applied if you had been suspected of committing a crime, in other words, probable cause. So it's a lower standard for being able to track the movements of individuals who are not accused of anything.
My guess is Dan. Go ahead.
And that's what has people worried.
Dana Priest is an investigative reporter with The Washington Post, winner of two Pulitzers. Also, the investigator in a program that will be run as part of the Frontline series tonight called Are We Safer? It airs at 9 o'clock tonight on PBS stations. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, it seems to me, and I know you don't want to give away everything from the show, but all of this is very impressive. In the end, it doesn't seem to have had much of an effect. All of the terrorism cases that we've seen recently have not, none of this has been involved in them. There was a Nigerian Christmas Day bomber who got through security, the so-called underwear bomber. There was there have been a number of cases where the cops have found potential terrorists, but they've done it through old-fashioned police work.
That's right.
Has any of all of this collection of data led to anything like uncovering of some kind of terror plot?
Well, the FBI says that they have five cases. They wouldn't share which ones they were. Five cases that have originated from this sort of data collection at the local level. They haven't made any convictions in those cases yet, and they wouldn't even talk about whether there have been people charged in the case. But what they've done is start full-blown FBI investigations. Short of that, they say that there are 100 examples, again, they wouldn't give them to me, of data collected in these cases by the local authorities that have enhanced already cases that have been already opened. One of those is the Colorado. One of those that we know about is in Colorado, where an Afghan was on his way to New York to allegedly blow up a building. And information from the Colorado Fusion Center allowed police to more quickly determine where he was. Now, some police and FBI said, well, you know, we probably would have gotten that anyway eventually. But so they weren't able to give me many instances of successes, and I did ask for that because you'd think that there would be, and over time there might be, and that's why they're willing to invest in this, because they believe that the notion of homegrown terrorists, people that are already here and maybe, you know, born here and converts or just become radicalized, is a growing problem, and they're hoping that this can help to solve that. On the other hand, if you look at these cases that you referred to, which include the person in Portland who wanted to blow up, allegedly wanted to blow up the Christmas tree lighting ceremony, or the fellow in Baltimore who wanted to blow up an Army recruiting center.
And then there's the Times Square bomber.
And the Times Square bomber. I've all been citizens or FBI sources that have come forward or informants, and in the two cases I cited, they then developed a sting operation in which they put an FBI undercover agent beside those people to carry out what they thought would become a violent attack and was not, and they were charged in that way, which is a more traditional route. So some critics say, you know, what you're doing is you're piling on more hay on the haystack where there's somewhere down at the bottom a needle. And the government would say, well, we need everything we can to try to find the needles around the United States.
Well, I wonder what would have happened if Margaret Burke White were working today. She took pictures of dams and bridges and all sorts of other things and traveled around, I'm sure, to places that some people would have seen as security risks. What about me? Yeah. If I take some pictures as I'm traveling through the country, am I putting myself at risk of getting on some terrorist list?
Well, actually, you are. It's not, you know, it's not a terrorist list, but it's a suspicious activities list, and you need to be able to prove to them that you're acting innocently. And when I've asked, well, how would one do that? The response was, well, if you're taking a photography class, you could give us the professor's name and a registration to the class. Well, what if you're not? What if you're just, it's going to be a matter of talking yourself out of it and showing them that you're innocent. And
I could have just bought a digital camera and want to use it, which a terrorist might also do.
Right. Well, this is the problem. This is the problem. And you know, some people who are in law enforcement are worried that it's going to create an unnecessary rift between your local police and the citizens in their local community, where, you know, relations should be good, not bad. And these are one of the efforts. They are trying to train people, but in the case in the paper that we describe, it's a where I got a hold of a suspicious activity report from California. There was a guy taking a cell phone picture of a ferry boat in Newport Beach, and this raised the alarms with a local police officer. Now, the report does not say that he looked Middle Eastern or anything about his physicalness, but you know, we know that there's unofficial profiling going on, and my hunch would be that if you are Middle Eastern looking, you're going to wind up much more in these databases, even though the FBI and Homeland Security say that is not a reason alone to put you in there. So there has to be something else, like taking a picture of the ferry. And these people were taking the picture. They were joined by children and another adult, and they got on the ferry and rode across the waterway. But the man who took the picture, who then went and sat in his car, and the car has a license plate, and the license plate was run through the databases, his name is in the database now. Not as a necessarily with the connection to terrorism, but they're waiting. His name would sit there in the hopes that they can either determine that absolutely for sure he doesn't have a connection, or if he's caught taking pictures elsewhere and people get more suspicious and they start to fill up the file on him, they may find something in his background or in his activities that really do cause them worry, in which case they would open an assessment and then an investigation.
This sounds like we're spending an awful lot of money on stuff that's going to lead nowhere. And with Congress talking about cutting budgets to reduce the deficit, has anybody talked about this?
Well, they have not at the federal level talked about this. It's not politically safe to roll back measures that have to do with terrorism. But I think the governors who actually run the state budgets are going to be, you know, taking a careful look at this as they need to trade off things that, you know, that are important in states. States are in such bad shape. So I'm not sure, you know, how that will work out in the budget, but I don't think it's going to get off scot-free, at least in terms of the debate around it at the state level.
Dana Priest, Are We Safer? Is going to be broadcast tonight at 9 on PBS stations. And I want to thank you so much for being with us again.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.